So welcome to the Overcoming Financial Trauma podcast. I'm your host, Rakim Sabri, and I cover financial trauma and financial empowerment for people who look like me. I have a very special first guest, and I will let her introduce herself.
Hi, my name is Asia Evans. I am a licensed mental health counselor and financial therapist. Rakim, I'm so excited to dive into this conversation. It's timely, it's needed. Sometimes I need it.
I think we all do. And, I shared in episode zero, kind of like the foundation of how I landed on this idea for the podcast and how I've been toying around with different concepts and people have been pushing me to jump into podcasting, but there's never been a topic that has held my attention and my passion in the way that financial trauma has. So I think that's a really good segue into how you define financial trauma and then the greater financial therapy as a whole.
Sure. I feel the same way. And more so, I will say like financial therapy holding my attention and my passion. So it's beautiful to have a comrade on this journey. So for me, financial therapy is about pulling back the layers of our relationship with money. Where did that come from? Where are those beliefs coming from? What are those narratives? What are the stories that you were told when you were growing up that you didn't realize were forming how you related to money and then impact what you do and how you behave with your finances when you're an adult? So when I think about financial therapy, it's about our feelings, our thoughts, our beliefs, our behaviors about money and how do they interact with what we actually do with our money, and looking into kind of the intersection between mental health and finances.
I think those are some great points, especially how these things start forming in childhood. I want us to pull back a layer, right, and talk about this through the lens of the Black experience, right? So oftentimes we don't have conversations about money, and when we do, they're usually negative conversations, right? There's a joke within our community around like the McDonald's money, right? You're driving in the car, mm-hmm. if you even have a car, right? Or we're walking down the street and we pass McDonald's and we ask our parents, hey, can we have McDonald's? And the response is, well, do you have McDonald's money? We have food mm-hmm. in the house. And I think from the perspective of nutrition, that's a good response, right? We have food in the house. But from, you know, the formulation of our relationship with money, especially at that age, placing the emphasis on McDonald's money, as we'll call it, really kind of talks about or points to this bad relationship that we have as a whole with money. So tell me about, as a practitioner, what are your thoughts on that concept? But then also, as a Black woman, what has your experience been in childhood? If you can give an example kind of related to the McDonald's money conversation, I think that would be really beneficial to the audience.
Yeah. So I think when I think about being a practitioner, it's so fruitful and complex when people are like, oh, you're a therapist, so you're going to talk about my parents. My relationship was fine. It's like a fun, quippy joke for them to say that. But it is true, like who we are and how we show up as fully formed adults is due to, whether positive or negative, the modeling and the examples that we saw, right? It might be despite of, it might be in spite of what you saw growing up. So when you're talking about kids and talk the conversation around McDonald's money, our ideas about money are formed between 7 and 9, they're solidified, right? And that is so young. And people, like kids they're not even like making money typically by that age, right? But the ideas, due to messaging, due to narratives, due to how they're seeing people behave and operate and tones and unspoken nonverbal language happening when talking about money is all absorbed. And we forget that kids are smart enough to like take that in, and then it sticks with them. So we have to be really mindful of what we're doing in front of kids and how we're doing it. And when I became a parent, I was like, holy shit, like I'm going to mess these kids up. Like, this is why we go to therapy, right? It was my parents. But really what it comes down to is how you operate as a person, as an adult, is 100% impacted by who you were, who you saw, who were you around, what were the messaging, what were the narratives when you were a kid. And like I said, it does not mean like, oh, I turned into my parents because of this, or, oh, I'm just like my grandpa because of that. It's more about, this is what I saw, and this went and poured into the foundation of who I am. And that matters. So for me, in preparation for this conversation, I actually was thinking about my life more in depth. And I think the way I, you know, going to grad school and practicing therapy and being in mental health, my schooling was very, very big on self as instrument. It's one of the points for being a mental health counselor and being a therapist, self as instrument, they kept saying all the time. And really what it means is you kind of have to do your own work to start doing the work. You have to be aware where your own biases are, where your own, in therapy world, we call it counter transference is. So what the client might bring up, what does that then bring up in you? So doing financial therapy was no different, right? I had to kind of like figure out where are my own pain points. So for me, I grew up very privileged. I had a very financially privileged upbringing, I think. I went to private schools all of my life. I would really define my upbringing as privileged compared to like what it could have looked like. However, what I did not realize was that in going to the suburbs to go to school and living in the city where I lived and being a Black kid, the way people looked at me and what I could have quote unquote been coming from was more underprivileged than I was. And I think my mindset as a child wasn't that we didn't have, but like there was a limit to what we had. Where I look back and I was like, actually, I was pretty privileged and probably one of the quote unquote wealthier kids in the class, in the burbs, but people like both my parents worked for the state. They had government jobs. They were good. Like we lived a nice life. I went on vacations. I don't want to say I was vacationing with the Obamas. I certainly wasn't, but I did go to Martha's Vineyard, right? So when I think about that, my childhood was privileged, but there was no conversation about money. I knew my mom was good with money and that she saved money, but I didn't know why. I didn't know why it was important to save money. And I would say that the things that became the most impactful for me were happening during college when it was time for me to be managing my money, right? And I started working at 14, right? It wasn't about, oh, I have money to go to the mall, or, oh, I can throw somebody $5 to put gas in their car, which, you know, that's how old I am, right? $5 would like do something to somebody's gas tank. Like you see the line actually moving. But I realized when I got to college and was paying my light bill, was having conversations around both my parents are separated. So who's paying the rent and from my rent in college, and are you paying it and can you? And when you can't, what happens and what does that mean for me? So navigating these issues that I knew I didn't have to, there was a level of financial stability growing up. But once I got to college, it was kind of like, okay, you're in there, you have loans, we're paying for what we can pay for. This parent is paying for that. That parent might be paying for that, and trying to navigate that all. And then, you know, continuing into young adulthood, that's when the hardships really started, you know, coming their way as they should. And they might've been there growing up, but they weren't in a way that I remember or felt them, but I do remember and I did feel them in college time and then, you know, throughout.
Yeah, I think that you brought up so many good points, and I was trying to take notes as I was listening, but I think the one that I want to kind of hone in on is important for this conversation, because oftentimes when we talk about the relationship between Black people and money, there is this kind of default connotation that Black people just struggle, right? That our experience is one of poverty. And when we back into your experience, right, you identified as being one of privilege, I think the financial trauma manifests on both sides of that spectrum, right? You go from stability and really just kind of like no concerns about the world financially anyway, into like, oh shoot, like this is an issue. How do I navigate that? Whereas, you know, my experience was kind of the opposite, right? My experience was one of poverty, and I feel completely equipped to navigate like those instances where the hot water is turned off, or we have to use candlelight to light up the apartment, or just kind of ignoring the incessant bill collectors. I mean, I remember I have several early experiences, but I remember one experience, bill collector called my home for my mom, and I picked up the phone and they're like, you know, asking where she is and when is she going to be back. And they're like, if she, you know, your mom is going to get into a lot of trouble if she doesn't respond or whatever.
No.
And I went to my mom and I was like super worried. Like, mom, this person said that you're going to get into a lot of trouble. And my mom picked up, you know, called the bill collector back, and she was like, don't you ever call my house and tell my son that I'm going to get in trouble. You know, I'll get to you when I'll get to you, or, you know, some, you know, interaction like that. But I was like, whoa, like what's going on? And literally I have not thought about that memory until just this moment, like as we're unpacking this. So I really appreciate you really shining a light on that perspective, because, you know, our experience is not a monolith. There is such a spectrum around how we navigate our personal finances, how we navigate wealth, how we navigate the family dynamic, and what that means for our relationship with money as it's forming in our childhood years, but also how we navigate our relationship with money as adults after having gone through those experiences. So let's talk about, so you are a financial therapist. Why don't we break down for the audience of people who don't know what financial therapy is? What is a financial therapist? How do you become one? And what is your focus in your practice?
Yeah, so, I mean, there are many ways that people can get to financial therapy, right? And I'll explain my way. So I am coming from a mental health background. So I got a bachelor. I decided very young that I needed to be a therapist. It was very important to me, very, very young. So I have a bachelor's in counseling psychology. I then went on to grad school and got a master's in counseling psychology. And I did 2 full-time years working to get licensed. I took a test and then I could become a licensed mental health counselor, which is when I felt comfortable calling myself a therapist. After that, I had been working and started on my own personal finance journey and realized that my clients were talking about money. And I was like, oh no, we all need to be talking about money, right? Like, I'm not the only one making it rain at brunch and shouldn't be or feeling uncomfortable when the group check comes, trying to secretly check my account. Like, that does not feel good. So when I realized that my clients were bringing that up, I created space within my practice to kind of talk about money and, you know, have these conversations. But it wasn't until I found the Financial Therapy Association, and another group is the Center for Financial Social Work. And I did both of those. I did the training for FTA and I did the certification for the Center for Financial Social Work. So that gave me additional specialization to then be like, okay, I'm kind of like niching down into financial therapy. So that's my road, but there are other people who have come from kind of the financial professional perspective and go get masters or don't. Like, there are a lot of different roads that people take to this type of work.
Yeah, we spoke at length about this at FTA conference. But just being able to take up space as a Black body in financial therapy is something that I'm passionate about, because one of the topics that I've gotten a lot of pushback on is like this whole concept of calling yourself a financial therapist, right? And so to your point, and I love that, you know, we are polar opposites in so many aspects of this conversation. My background is mostly finance, right? Like I worked in the banking industry for a decade. And then after that, I went into financial coaching, got certified to instruct on financial education, so on and so forth. And so when people like hear my name, or they, you know, think of the brand that I've built around my name, one of the first things, if not the first thing that comes to mind, is personal finance. But what people don't know, what I often don't talk about, is that my schooling background was in psychology. Initially, I wanted to be a psychiatrist. And then I was just like, once I learned more about psychiatry, I was like, well, I don't want my practice to be based off of medicine. I want my practice to be based off of counseling. So then I you know, changed my major from pre-med to psychology. And that was like, that was the focus. And then of course I started making money in banking and I didn't finish school. So now discovering financial psychology as like an emerging field, and more specifically financial therapy, it's really kind of like this full circle story for me, where it's like, okay, I get to get back to the roots of where my original passion was with all of this financial acumen. I get to serve people from a behavioral perspective. But because I don't have the credential, you know, from academic perspective, even at a bachelor's degree level, and I don't have the mental health background that you do, there is definitely some clash in the way that people like me can present and brand themselves as financial therapists. And I don't use the term financial therapist in my branding. I use the term financial coach, but I have seen and have had conversations with other Black bodies who do the work without the credential. So talk to me about, and we've talked about this before off stage, but let's talk about it, you know, for a conversational sake. What does, in your experience, the gatekeeping around credential versus non-credential look like? And what do you think the solve to bridging that gap is for members of our community, particularly underscoring the fact that there's a lot of mistrust in these industries, whether that be medical, whether that be financial, for the, you know, Black consumers?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think first it's just, there's never enough experience that's going to cover all of the experience of an individual, right? Like, and as important as it is for me to show up and be a therapist, right? I also know that my experience isn't everybody's experience, and there needs to be voice to other people's experiences. And it's branding. And I think people, we get so caught up in what our titles are. And listen, I am currently paying a lot of money for my master's degree, right? Like I still have student loans, and that's important to me. And calling myself as a therapist is important to me. And I had to figure out how I felt about calling myself a financial therapist. I had to figure out within me, nobody else could tell me, is this okay? Who's a financial therapist? Who isn't a financial therapist? What does this mean? I had to personally have my own reckoning of who got to call themselves a financial therapist and who doesn't, right? And I think it's really easy for people to decide who can and can't do that when they don't know. Does that make sense? Like if there isn't a ton of concrete examples of a Black person showing up who is calling themselves a financial therapist, who's coming from the mental health side, who's coming from the financial side, how do we know where the line is? And I think the way that we figure that out is by having these conversations together, because what I might be offering is going to be more mental health heavy, because that's where I'm comfortable, right? So when a lot of my clients may come to me, they're starting with their mental health, right? They're coming to me saying, Asia, I am anxious. In building rapport, in building a relationship, in diving in, we then are able to really start uncovering their money stuff. Because sometimes, especially in the Black community, they don't want to come to me and say, hey, Asia, I'm struggling with my money. But they feel more comfortable coming to me saying, I'm depressed, or I don't like my life. And I have money stuff that comes up, but it may not be led with that, right? However, there might be other people who are able to say that, but want to say that to you and not to me, right? Oh, go in therapy, especially in our communities, is so stigmatized. All the proverbs, right? Like, you don't tell anybody else what's happening under our roof. You don't tell anybody else what's happening in our house. So going to a therapist can feel taboo or stigmatized, but going to a financial professional feels better. Right? Going to a financial coach feels better. That does not mean that a coach cannot start talking about somebody's financial trauma. That does not mean that a different financial professional can't. The crossing of it is when it's like, okay, are we dealing with a depression, anxiety, bipolar? You can list the medical diagnosis for mental health, right? Are we dealing with something that is going on for this person that I cannot help with, that I don't have the capacity to handle and hold? And I think that's where we all get tripped up trying to decide, hey, this is your lane and this is my lane. And it makes sense, right? There's a space for that, but there's going to be some weaving into other people's lanes on occasion. And that doesn't mean it's bad. It doesn't mean it's not necessary. I really got into this work because I needed a financial therapist. I was burning my husband out talking about money all the time. We're a young family. I have a 3-year-old and I have a 1-year-old, and daycare legit is $3,500 a month. That is just daycare. I'm in New York City area. That's what daycare costs. That's a ton of money, right? That's multiple times people's mortgage. So, and when I was, you know, stressed out about it, I was like, my husband wants to talk about this, but I'm talking about the same things over and over again. I want to talk to a therapist who is specializing in that. And at the time, I didn't find anyone who was Black and looked like me. And I was like, oh, I got to help fill this gap, because I love it. And I love talking about it, and talking about it and writing for my own self has been helpful too. So that is a very long answer that I could go on and on to figuring out what our lane is. And the first thing is to do no harm, right? Do no harm to your clients, to the people that you are working with. But there might be some times when we're weaving into each other's lanes, whatever those lanes may be. And that is not a bad thing, because we need all of the voices, truly.
Yeah, you know, you touched on something too that I want to underscore as well. At least in some of the pushback that I've received in talking to other financial therapists who are coming from a mental health background, is the concern from the mental health community that financial therapists who are coming from a financial background are going to be out here diagnosing. And it's not been my experience as a financial professional, or even a professional that has had a limited experience with, you know, psychology, that there's a desire to diagnose anybody, right? Like, I don't think in any session that I'm going to say, oh man, you know, sounds like you're depressed. Maybe you need to, you know, take some depression medication, right? Or sounds like you are bipolar, right? Like, that's not my place to even approach. In the same way that, so I'm not a licensed financial professional either. I'm not going to listen to somebody who says, oh, I have, you know, $10,000 and I want to know what stocks are invested in. I'm not going to tell you what stock to invest it in, because that's not my lane. I'm not licensed in that. So I think When we talk about the weaving into other people's lanes, that it's important for us to like recognize that there may not be a desire to like step on your foot as a mental health professional or to step on the foot of a licensed financial advisor, because I don't even have the knowledge to begin, right? And I do come from a banking background, so I do take the fiduciary responsibility a little serious. I mean, I was beat over the head with compliance every year of my experience in banking, but I know that not every financial coach has a background in banking or who has an understanding of compliance and the regulations and et cetera. So I don't want to paint myself the unicorn, but I think it's important as we're looking at this and as we are actively engaged in the community of financial therapy and financial psychology, and then the smaller community on, I shouldn't say smaller, but the community of those individuals that serve Black people specifically who have a Black experience, that to your point, we need to incorporate representation and the other voices and the other perspectives into the equation. You and I, I'm just gonna, you know, brag on us for a second, participated in a panel at FTA's conference on inclusion around financial therapy and what that looks like. How do we make it a more inclusive space? And it was really interesting that you and I in that room full of people were the only Black people present, talking about inclusion, talking about the need for inclusion, providing our feedback, our experiences. And I'm sure you remember this, but there was a question, like, how do we shake things up? Why are there no white men on this panel? And do you remember my response?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I do.
I was just like, there are those of us who are not looking to infiltrate your spaces. Like, there are those of us who want to create our own spaces. And we're not looking for the validation of somebody who is outside of our community to tell us that we can do this work, that we're qualified to do this work, or how to go about doing this work. Because I think a lot of the work includes leveling, includes understanding culturally what is our experience. And just like you said, just like I said, the McDonald's money and the, you know, don't air the dirty laundry outside of the household and all of the stigmas around getting help from a mental health perspective or talking about money. Like, those are things that are not, you're often not going to see those in curriculum, right? You're not going to see those in academia. You're going to see methods and strategies and approaches, right? And so we need to acknowledge and incorporate those experiences into the way that we practice so that we can meet people where they are.
Right. And I think to your point, like, that requires an individual approach, right? That requires your story. That requires my story to help implement and shift and strategize and have the mechanisms. And a lot of it may be lived experience, right? As a Black person, to then share to somebody else, like, hey, this is what I went through. And to the example that we gave, right? Like, I'm coming from a privileged background. You're like, well, that wasn't my experience. I'm coming from mental health. You're like, I'm coming from finance. But the two of us understand exactly what we're doing and how we're trying to help and how we are helping. And that, to me, is the example of when you may swerve into each other's lanes and it's okay. And I think that that is what's really important. And it's, when you're talking about individuals, it's so incredibly nuanced. It's so complex. No book is going to encompass every single person's lived experience. It's just not going to happen, right? And that should never be the expectation. But I think you nailed it when you said, I'm not trying to diagnose anybody. And I mean, right now, no financial therapist is diagnosing anyone with anything but gambling, I believe, right? Like, we're not diagnosing anyone. But can we treat somebody's sadness when it comes to their financial trauma, right? Can you work with somebody talking about their financial stressors? Can you work with somebody about their financial stress? Yeah. Yes. Because not only do you understand, like, listen, I work in New York City and I've worked all over New York City. I cannot, they know who the therapists are, right? They know, oh, Asia, you're a social worker. You look like a social worker. I see the neighborhood you're in. You're dressed like a social worker. I'm like, I'm actually not a social worker, but I am a therapist. I'm a mental health counselor. Like, we can get into nuances of that. We don't need to. They do not want to come to me and have a conversation with me about their finances when they're like, I need to make sure I am okay. Like, I am not okay. That's it. Or I just got out of the hospital. We will eventually get there. But first, it has to be like, they need to let me in the door. You know? So pretending that that these idealistic images of how we treat people are always going to work is just not the case. And it's just so much.
No, you're spot on. So I grew up in New York. I'm not there currently, but just going back to that whole concept of branding, right? We talk about people can see a social worker from a mile away. Well, we got to think about too, like the connotations, you know, of that term social worker, right? If somebody is viewing you as a social worker, I remember when I was growing up, my exposure to social workers were through Child Protective Services, CPS.
Yes.
And so, like, there is like this fear that exists, I think, in Black communities, particularly Black communities that are dealing with poverty, that social workers are going to come in and take my children or take me as a child away from my parents because of something that they can't control, right? I don't remember what the reason was that CPS came to like my house when we were super young, but I just remember there was a whole panic around it. Like, my parents were there, my grandfather came, you know, we were there, and, you know, they interviewed each one of us. And at the time, it was just me and my brother. I think my sister was very, very young, but they interviewed us, they asked us questions, and it was just kind of like, are we being, I just remember the anxiety in that situation as a child. Like, are we being interviewed to potentially be taken away from our parents? And I think I know what the situation was. I think my parents had left us at home, me and my brother. And we were younger, but we were not like babies, right? Well, I don't think we were teenagers, but we were definitely old enough to like be at home by ourselves. And I think the landlord had come by. I don't want to create a memory, but I think this is what happened. I think the landlord had come by, knocked on the door, and we didn't answer because we were told don't answer the door when we're not home, right, by our parents. And we heard the landlord put the key in the door and open the door. And so we assumed that because the door was being opened, that it was our parents. So we jump out to greet our parents and realize that it's not them. And they're like, where are your parents at? And we're like, you know what I'm saying? So like, it became a thing. And I just remember there was so much anxiety in the house leading up to the appointment. It's like, oh my God, are they gonna come and take us away from our parents? And how do we answer this question? And all the coaching that we had received ahead of it. So, you know, without derailing this conversation in its entirety, I think, you know, talking about that experience is important because that could be a very real fear when you're approaching people, particularly in New York, from the perspective of, well, I'm a therapist, not a social worker, but they're viewing you through this lens of you're the big bad wolf coming to break up my family.
Yeah, 100%. And you're a worker, right? Like it could be a social worker, it could be a therapist. Like colloquially, right? People use that those terms like interchangeably, right? So like a license, could I walk around, I am a licensed mental health counselor? Sure, I could, but like I wasn't going to do that. And you're right, like the labeling of a profession is really what we're talking about, right? Like you label a profession and the experience that communities have had with that profession, right? And that interaction that communities have had with that, with the job. And you're right. Like there are so many instances where I have had to call CPS. I have accidentally called CPS when I didn't need to, because I made a mistake. Like that sticks with me forever. Like this happened like 15 years ago. And I'm like, oh my God, I called CPS on this woman and I didn't need to, because I read her like meds wrong. And I was working in substance use, and that was really important at the time, you know. And there's a duty that we, you know, our code of ethics is like, do no harm, and you have to protect certain populations, right? Like the elderly, kids, like certain populations, you are swearing an oath to say that I am a mandated reporter. I'm going to say something if, you know, if something's uncomfortable, just to check it out. But if somebody in the community has seen what that looks like in the past, if that's a memory, even if you were there to help, and you are usually there to help, I want to believe the good in everybody. So I'm going to say people are always there to help, right? That doesn't mean that a memory that you don't know that somebody had of a worker coming to their house, they feel good about it. They want to let you in. And I know, especially with kids, it's really hard to go through that. You know, it's hard to, you're worried about CPS. So it's just, these are the layers, the traumas that we talk about when we're then like, oh yeah, but let's talk about your retirement. Oh yeah. Well, you know, like it, this is why it's so important to encapsulate everybody's story and understand that everyone is coming from something different, because that one memory might change how they interact with you for the rest of their lives.
Right. Right. You know, you touched on something that I was going to do a whole separate episode on, but I feel like now is like the right opportunity to take advantage of it. And you talked about retirement. And so I have a weekly newsletter that I send out called Overcoming Financial Trauma as well. And maybe 2 weeks ago, I sent out a newsletter based off of an interview that I did with someone for their podcast, where I was asked, it was a white guy, I was asked, why do I think people don't prioritize retirement until later in life? And my response was, some of us don't think that we'll live that long. And then, you know, this week, there was a rapper from the group Migos who was killed. He was 28 years old. And it hit me. And I'm not like a huge hip hop fan. And I like some of Migos' music. And, you know, I've listened to some of them and danced to some of them. You know, had a good time. So I think it was more of the fact that, and unfortunately, we're in this, let's call it, crisis within, you know, the hip hop industry, where we're seeing so many young Black men being lost to gun violence or violence in general, that made me reflect. I was like, man, I just wrote this 2 weeks ago. And, you know, this young man did not get to see the age of 30, could have been planning for retirement or could have not been planning for retirement. And what this, from my perspective, what this signals to people who, to young Black men specifically, who listen to this music, who frequent environments that, you know, the lifestyle kind of embodies, are internalizing and saying, well, you know what, like if this can happen to this person, it can happen to me. So I'm not gonna plan for retirement. And how that perpetuates a trauma on a subconscious level that we're probably not even thinking about. And I share this story fondly about how from probably about the age of 15 to, you know, between the ages of 15 and 30, my dad would always like marvel on my birthdays of where I am versus where he was at that particular age. And I think around the time I turned 30, my dad told me that it was such a blessing to see me hit 30, because there was a long time in his life that he didn't think that he was going to make it to 30. And, you know, we've unpacked that. Maybe that'll be an episode by itself, right? Where, you know, I'm talking to my dad, but we've unpacked that conversation. And, you know, I told him, like, it's never crossed my mind that I wasn't going to make it to 30. Like, it's never been a thought that I could be in the wrong place at the wrong time, that I could step off the curb and get hit by a bus, that, like, none of those things. And I have a maybe heightened level of situational awareness when I'm traveling or I'm out and about, but just to kind of think, like, that people are out there really thinking this way. And I'm not one of those people. And my dad's like, well, that's breaking a generational curse, right? And so we talk about the evolution from generation to generation. And it's still like, it never like settled in my head. Like, how can I understand intellectually how somebody can think this way based off of their environment, how they grew up, et cetera, et cetera. But like, I don't understand that innately, like how somebody can feel that way, until I had a friend who had just turned 30 in December. And then the next year in February, we lost him to gun violence as well. He was shot, he was killed. And I'm like, man, like, he only got to live like for a month and a half, maybe, past his 30th birthday. Somebody that I thought, you know, I was gonna be able to grow old and, you know, make reference to the good old days with, right? Gone. And so when we have these conversations and we're talking about mental health and we're talking about money at the same time, when we have these conversations around how do we deliver quality content, education, resources to people, Black people specifically, and I'm gonna even go deeper into, you know, young Black men, encouraging them to do things like long-term plan for retirement, when they're being bombarded with images of young Black men who are not even making it into their 30s, 40s, 50s. And so how do you answer the question of why, right? Like, if you go and you have a conversation with, let's say, a 21-year-old, and I'm creating this hypothetical, and it's an extreme hypothetical, so humor me. You have a conversation with a 21-year-old around his own financial traumas, or the makeup that he doesn't really identify as financial trauma yet, and you bring up retirement, and he says something to you like, well, why am I gonna plan for retirement? I'm not gonna live that long. Like, how do you, as a financial therapist, but also as a Black woman, how do you respond to something like that?
I mean, this, to me, like the therapist clinician in me would just be like on it, right? Like, that is who is gonna come out, because it's also who I am as a person, which is why I decided so young that I'm like, oh, I need to be a therapist. It's just who I am. But listening to this 21-year-old young Black male in front of me tell me that he doesn't think all, I'm like, that must be so hard to think that your life is literally less than 10 years is going to expire. That sounds fucking scary. Like, let's just be here in that. Like, this is scary. And you're right, we're not going to talk about retirement right now, because we need to talk about what it feels like for you to live day in, day out, not thinking you're going to make it for 6 months, a year, 3 years, 5 years. Like, no, you're right, we're not talking about retirement right now. We're going to talk about how do you navigate your life right now if you are concerned that it's going to be ending in the next 9 years. What do we need to do to help you feel more comfortable that maybe that can be pushed to 15? Can that be pushed to 20? What do we need to create in your life? What systems, what access, what opportunities do we need to start accessing resources in a way that will allow you to make space to even dream, dare to dream that you will need a retirement? Because right now, when you are in that trauma, because that's a trauma state, like, no, we're not talking about retirement. We're talking about, okay, this is your reality. Let's think about what we can do that's going to help you to feel like your reality can be longer than 30.
Great answer. Great answer. I don't think we could top that.
I'm like, oh, we'll go there. Like, who's showing up? I'll tell you who's showing up. Yeah. And that's real, right? Like, I've sat with people going through that. The thing about my mental health experience is that I've worked with three-year-olds. I've worked in substance use. I have worked with people who have been in a state psychiatric center for literally 20 years. That is home. That's their house. Like, that's their home. And to say, hey, I'm going to drive you from what used to be your home from the last 2 decades to your new apartment. And I literally have been that person doing that and going shopping for socks and a mop and how do you clean your apartment and what do you do? And that has just taught me that there you have to prioritize the person and meet them where they are at. Your young man is not in the position to be talking about retirement, but he might be in a position to talk about, okay, what do you want your life to look like? Do you have hope? Do you have some hopes for yourself? How can we grow that? How can we feed that? That might be, okay, you know what? How do we get an extra $500 saved? Let's start there. No, it does not need to be millions of dollars. You can retire early. Like, let's just get $500 saved. Okay, who do you think you're trying to take care of, right? And build from there. It cannot, we are not jumping there because that's not his experience.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, that question is super huge. What do you want your life to look like? Let's close it up. Tell people where they can find you because I want people to find you.
Thank you. So you can find me on IG at Asia, AJAE Therapy. That's also my same name on TikTok. I'm growing my TikTok, if you will. And I'm on LinkedIn at Asia Evans LMHC and at my website, asiaevanscounseling.com.
And I will include all of those links in the notes. Feels so cool to say that. I have my own podcast now. But this has been Overcoming Financial Trauma Podcast with my very first guest. And Asia, thank you so much for sharing your expertise and your wisdom and your experience with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited.